So it's extremely gratifying to have Michael Berry with us this evening. Seems like the noise that I'm making is not very satisfying. I'll try not to breathe in between words. Professor Berry received his PhD from, should I stand further back? Is this better? Professor Berry received his PhD from St. Andrews University and has been at Bristol University in the UK shortly thereafter for the lion's share of his professional career, where he still remains. He is now the Royal Society Research Professor at Bristol University. He is an extremely renowned mathematical physicist who has won a great many awards, ranging from obviously being elected to the Royal Society earlier in his career, to the Wolf Prize, and most recently, or perhaps more notably for many people in the audience, he has also received a knighthood, so I should properly be addressing him as Sir Michael Berry. Professor Berry is renowned for bringing a great many interesting approaches in mathematical physics to his work, his breadth ranging from quantum theory to spin statistics to singularities to interesting aspects of pure mathematics, certainly including but not limited to the Riemann hypothesis. Professor Berry is a physicist for the originator and the founder of the Berry phase. And he is also an extremely well-regarded popularizer, and I hope I'm not building expectations up too highly for you. He has a wonderful rapport and a light touch that I'm sure you will enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Michael Berry.
Last remark, I have a colleague who says that you've heard the hype, now you're going to get the load. Mathematics and physics have evolved together, and they remain intimately connected, right at the core. Sometimes it's important to distinguish them as separate scientific activities, different intellectual activities. You know, you have people who are called mathematicians and people who are called physicists. But in our everyday scientific practice, it can be very hard to tell them apart. Peter Atkins says, determining where mathematics ends and science begins is as difficult and as pointless as mapping the edge of a morning mist. Well, I spend my life wandering in and out of that mist. So please don't waste time wondering whether this is going to be a physics talk or a mathematics talk. Now, I've tried to be non-technical, but that doesn't mean that the presentation is elementary. I mean, some of the ideas are fairly sophisticated. I would characterize the talk as intellectual but non-technical. Now, nowhere are the intimate connections between mathematics and physics more immediate than in optics. With our own eyes and our brains, a fact that I'll come back to at the end, we can see through physical phenomena almost directly what I'm tempted to call mathematical phenomena. I'm going to show you some mathematical phenomena and their counterparts in light, turning mathematics into light, indeed, or is it the other way around? Well, to start, here's 1 + 1 = 2. Nothing could be simpler. Okay. Well, in optics, this reflects the fact that if you have two candles or two flashlights, the intensities add. But flashlight is messy light, and for pure light, intensities do not add. 1 + 1 is not equal to 2. And the reason for that is that waves add, and waves have an additional property called phase. Phase measures the stage that something's at, which oscillates. You know, the phases of the moon's shape oscillates from thin to fat and back again once a month. Clock time oscillates, goes from 0 to 12 hours or 24 and then back again. And the stage of an oscillation is the phase. And when you add waves, the differences of phase cause interference. And so depending on the phase, the intensity you get can be anything between 0 and 4. It can be 0, you can get perfect blackness by adding 1 plus 1 in terms of intensities. But this leads to a problem, because if you do have this richer behavior, what is it that two flashlights are twice as bright as one? And that's the beginning of a deep idea. You see, if you take this same picture, the intensity, which wiggles up and down as you change the phase difference between the two waves that you're adding, and then you realize that in messy light, you don't actually know what the phase is. It's varying very, very rapidly. The atoms in the bulb of the flashlight are emitting completely uncorrelated waves with each other. The phase is changing very rapidly in space and in time. So you never will see this. You'll see the average of it. And the average over the messiness is indeed 2. Nowadays, we have a fancy name for this. It's the beginning of what's called decoherence. It's the washing out of the interference effects by external effects that you can't control. Here, it's a way of complicated way of restoring 1 plus 1 equals 2. It was very necessary for Thomas Young to begin to understand this 200 years ago when he tried to convince the world that light was indeed a wave phenomenon. He was showing interference, but he had to explain why you don't see it all the time. He did his experiments with candle flames, so you have to be very careful through the little pinholes. Decoherence is a deep idea, as I've mentioned. It doesn't seem deep here, you're just averaging something that wiggles. But it plays a part in fundamental physics in understanding how the classical world on our everyday scales emerges from the quantum world where everything is waving. I won't go into that, as it's ended up right. So let me show you some interference. This is interference near a caustic. Caustic comes from the Greek word for burning. It's a line of focused light, like the patterns you get in burning glasses in the lit by the sun. But there's a line of focused light. Let me see if I can focus this on the focused light. You see? That's the line of light, and you have interference. The phase is increasing as you go down. It looks a bit abstract, and I'll tell you later how I made this picture, but many of you have been fortunate enough to see this in rainbows. Now, these are interference fringes in a rainbow, coloured because, of course, the rainbow light is white and split up. You see these alternations, they're called supernumerary rainbows, whenever the raindrops are almost all the same size and not too large, as depends on the weather. To understand how this works and introduce some more mathematical ideas, let me go back to 1638, Descartes' explanation of the raindrop as sunshine on a dripping cloud. Here's a drip, raindrop, 3 millimeters across. And here's the light coming in, here's the light coming out. The point is that although the light coming in is uniformly distributed, it comes from a long way away, the light coming out is not. It's concentrated in a particular direction. So you, looking up, see, brightly lit, all those raindrops on whose direction, it's actually a cone because you have to rotate about this line, it's spherical, not flat, your eyes are situated. And that's a rainbow ray, it's a caustic of the light. Now, the point is that inside, 2 rays come out in each direction. If you draw a graph of the bending of the light that comes in at different latitudes, there you are, the curve is folded, and it means that there are 2 rays that come out in any given direction. Mathematicians have a name for this. It's called a 2-to-1 map. Now, a map of Waterloo, which was 2-to-1, wouldn't be much use. It means that every place in Waterloo is represented by 2 points on the map, not 1. You get that if you fold the map over. That's not useful, of course. But in mathematics, these have more general structures, and the rainbow is one of them. Now, as you go towards the rainbow, if you go down, these 2 points come together, and that's called a singularity of the map, and that's what a caustic is. That's a 2-to-1 map. I'll show you a many-to-1 map now. This is the sun sparkling on Lake Como. That's a many-to-1 map from the sun to the eye via the water at any given instant. There are many bright points. Each bright point is a place where the water has exactly the slope to reflect light into the eye. Now, as time passes and the water waves, these points move around and they come together in pairs and disappear, or they're born in pairs. Those moments, called twinkles, are singularities of the map, and what's happening then is above the water in the space, a surface of focused light, we're in three dimensions, not two, is passing across your eye. And it's the rapid succession of those singularities, these twinkles, that give the water its sparkling appearance. So the sparkling of water is a succession of singularities of a many-to-one map. There's the whole mathematics of this type of phenomenon, and it's called catastrophe theory. I won't tell you where the name comes from, it comes from different applications of it. Let me talk a little bit about these caustics. This mathematic describes natural focusing, the kind of focusing very different from what the lens maker strives to achieve at the perfect point focus of an ideal lens. That's a very unstable thing, it's hard to do. Typically, you get surfaces in space, that's what I'm speaking about now. So caustics are the physical embodiment of this mathematics. And let me show you. Here's light from a wavy surface or a mirror, the surface of the sea, for example, one of these fairground mirrors. You see the rays there, and you see the caustics on which focusing occurs. They're curious things. They're holistic, if I dare to use this New Age term, which begins to sound a bit old-fashioned, I have to say. In the sense that no single ray can come to a focus. It's a property of the family of rays. It's the surface, or in this two dimensions, the lines that they all touch. Here are some. The simplest one is called the fold. The next one is called the cut. You see, it looks like a folding sheet of paper. It comes from that folding curve I showed you. Here are some caustics, a small part of which constituted the picture I showed you at the beginning, a little bit round here, made by taking a piece of bathroom window glass, wiggly undulating bathroom window glass, with undulations about a millimetre across, and shining a laser beam through, which has also a size of about a millimetre. Different rays within that beam pass through different parts of the landscape of the glass and are bent differently, and you get focusing. And you get the caustics, and you get in regions where more than one ray is hitting, you get interference. And because laser light is pure light, you see lots and lots of these fringes. So we come to the question of geometrical caustics. These are ray phenomena, but they're decorated by waves. And I've already shown you this picture. The wave that decorates this was understood by George Airy, the Astronomer Royal, in about 1838. It's the same wave that describes the physics of the rainbow, and we look in detail and try to understand how the waves interfere with each other. Here's a picture of a graph of it. You've seen the same pattern, and you probably don't realize it, as the V-shaped pattern behind a moving ship or boat. Now, curiously enough, it's the same pattern whether you've got a battleship or whether you've got a duck's wing, providing that there are limits to it. There are an enormously wide range of scales. You get the same pattern. There it is again. This V-shape is a caustic of the water rays, and for reasons to do with the physics of water waves, it's always the same angle. The double angle is about 39 degrees, and it's as you go across that you see this airy rainbow pattern. It looks different, but it's actually exactly the same pattern. The cusp, which is the next one in this little hierarchy of patterns that mathematics gives you, is the wave that decorates this sort of pointy shape. And one feature I want to draw your attention to is that you've got these pairs, not very clear that they're pairs, but it will be in a moment, of complete destructive interference, zero, perfect blackness. As I say, we'll come back to that. And there they are. Now, if you compute rather than observe, you can resolve these more clearly, and there they are, these zeros. They come in pairs. As I say, we'll get back to that. Now, another piece of mathematics stemming from this physics infinite series. Okay. Here's this same rainbow wave as I showed you, and there it is. Now, Airy had a mathematical expression for this, but he couldn't calculate it outside a very narrow range near the middle. It was too difficult for the mathematics of the day. Now, if you're not a physicist, you probably think of physics as a very exact science. Indeed, it is the most exact quantitative representation of some aspects of reality that human beings have created. But still, most of the time, we don't work with exact mathematics. We can't. The problems are too hard. You have to use approximations. Welcome, everybody. You have to use approximations. And a common kind of approximation is this. You make a guess or a rough thing, and you get a number. Say you get a half. And then you improve it a bit. You add on some correction, a quarter. And then another one, you add on an eighth. You get a little series like that. And of course, this one, you can guess, adds up to 1, 3, 4, 7, 8, and so on. We call this a convergent series, an infinite sequence of operations which lead to a result which is finite. It took a very long time for humanity to appreciate this point. And it underlay one of the great paradoxes, Zeno. Pose the paradox that it's impossible to ever get anywhere. Why? Because first you must cover half the distance. Well, having done that, you must cover half the distance that remains, and again and again. Now, he realized that movement was not impossible, and he wasn't rooted to the spot his whole life. But he saw there was a conceptual problem, and it's resolved by the fact that infinitely many quantities can add up to something finite. But in mathematics, you get more exotic sequences of successive approximants than this. You have divergent series. For example, you have 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8. Okay, this is going to seem like a joke to you, but there are ways of making sense of this mathematically, and this one gives you minus 1. Okay, here's another one. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 minus 1 12th. Let me tell you a story. My wife's a biologist, and I have to tell you that she knows a lot more things in mathematics than I know biology. We read in bed, okay, we sit there, and I had a bookmark given to me by a software company called Mathematica. They're very generous, you spend hundreds of thousands of pounds every year, and they send you a bookmark. It's a freebie. And these bookmarks have little formulas on them. And on this particular bookmark was this formula. And my wife said, what's that? I said, well, it's a mathematical regularization, Riemann Zeta regularization of a divergent, which is nonsense. How can you have positive quantities adding up to something? They can all say, well, it's advanced mathematics, I would put a robust domestic disagreement ensued. Now, these kinds of series are not enormously useful, but there's an intermediate kind which is. And that Stokes realized that exactly this intermediate kind is useful in the rainbow. It looks like this. You start correcting, and it looks as though things are getting better. But then after a while, it turns out that what's on the top wins over what's on the bottom, and the contributions get bigger. You have the head and you have the tail. And, well, he guessed, and now it's understood, that this does have a meaningful sum, and it's pretty well close to where you would stop before it starts to go wrong. And this type of series is extraordinarily useful throughout mathematical physics. You count them all over the place. And in the rainbow, it's associated with this. Going from the bright side of the rainbow, where you have two rays, to the dark side, well, I said you have no light, but it's not quite no light. It's a kind of decaying ray. And Stokes wondered how you get from one side to the other. So it's mathematically very strange to have two on one side and one on the other. And he realized the following, that as you go from the dark side to the bright, one becomes two. The new ray is born out of this infinite and previously thought of as meaningless tail of the series that describes the first one. It's very deep, very strange mathematics, which we're still understanding now, nearly 200 years later. So that's divergent series. Now, I told you at the beginning, we started with 1 plus 1 equals 2. And I said, nothing is simpler. Well, nothing is simpler. So when you talk about zero now, there's much ado about nothing. There are curious intellectual fashions. There have been at least 3 popular books about zero in the last few years. There are some very abstract zeros in mathematics called the Riemann zeros. I'm not speaking about them today, but they're the basis of one of these million-dollar clay prize problems. And there are 3 non-technical books about those zeros. So kind of nothing is the sort of flavor of the day. Anyway, I'm going to go back to these zeros in waves, the places of perfect destructive interference, complete blackness. I've shown you already these zeros here. Now, what happens when a wave is zero? When something is zero, and what I'm drawing here, I should have said, this is the brightness and the intensity of the light, color code, that's bright and black is dark. When light is no light, you can't tell what the phase is. There's nothing to oscillate. It's a special place, it's a singularity. So if instead of this picture, we make a map of the phase of the light, using again color, because color is periodic. You go around through the colors of the rainbow, red, green, blue, and so on, then back through purples to red again. You find that everywhere you have one of these zeros, you have a place where all the colors meet. It's a very dramatic way of seeing these phase singularities. You get them everywhere. I mean, if you take random waves, if you add waves going in many different directions, here's a little sum of 20 or so waves, here's the phase, and you can see every time there's a black point, there's a place where all the colors meet. It's as meaningless to ask what's the phase at one of these points as it is to ask what's the time at the North Pole. That's also a singularity of this phase, this time, 20 clock time on the Earth. These random waves are very important nowadays. They're studied in many different contexts. So pictures like this could represent, for example, laser speckle. If you shine a laser on a white wall, you've seen kind of shimmering, speckly patterns. It could be a section of the black body radiation that pervades the universe. Or it could be represent the electron wave in a chaotic quantum dot. There are many different applications of random waves. These phase singularities are pervasive. They're points in 2 dimensions, but they're lines in 3. Now, these lines can be curved, they can be closed, and we learned recently that they can be knotted and linked. Now, this brings in more mathematics, knot theory. It's a very elementary knot theory. But I'm talking about knots that can be wound on the torus, on the donut. You can specify such a knot by the number of times you wind one way, number of times you wind the other before you close. So that's 2, 3, and that's 3, 7. Okay. Now, you can create optical beams, and experimenters are now doing this, following these theoretical suggestions. You can create optical beams where the black lines, the zeros, are knotted. So there's a representation of a very complicated beam, just using the zeros as a skeleton, and there's a trefoil knot, and here's a simple link. These are threads of black light. They're, if you like, knotted nothings. As I'm speaking now in the room, the sound wave bouncing around have a thread in the forest of these lines, threads of silence, lines of no sound. They move very fast, and so you don't hear them, you don't hear their absence, so to speak, but they are there. They form a kind of skeleton, a very complicated wave. Here, another piece of mathematics, but also related to these zeros. What's color vision? Well, think what hits a point on your retina. It's a spectrum. To specify it, you'd have to say how much light of each wavelength strikes that point. You need infinitely many numbers for that. We don't see that richness. We only see 3 numbers because we've only got 3 cones, 3 types of cones in the eye. So color vision projects from the infinite dimensional space of spectra down to the 3-dimensional space of color. And color vision in that respect isn't as rich as our hearing, where we do hear to a large extent essentially every single sound frequency that's in the noise that comes into our ear. So I'm going to illustrate this with the colors of darkness. Now, Suppose you have one of these optical patterns where, because of interference, you've got points of blackness, but you make it in white light, so the points of blackness for the different wavelengths in the white light are in slightly different places. Okay. Now, those colours are anyway dim and indistinct, but the separation of the colours is greatest near the zeros, but it's very frustrating because precisely there's very little light, so you can't see the patterns. You get these sort of smudgy pictures like this, it's just a constructed one, but there are sort of zeros dotted around, you can hardly see the little smudges of colour. However, if you can do this easily on a computer, so an instrument made of software, if you magnify the intensity so it's the same everywhere, but keep the colours the same, we call this the chromoscope, then you lighten the darkness while you preserve the colours, then suddenly it's the same picture. You see everywhere these universal little patterns dotted around. And that these are up to some distortions. And it's a recently discovered pattern. There's no green here for a reason. These are the universal colours of dark light. And there's been an experiment recently in Scotland that has actually created this rather strange colours of darkness. They're really curiosity. Now let's look at interference again, but extreme interference. Okay. One of the physicists' favourite devices is the diffraction grating. And what that is, it's an opaque screen with a set of slits or holes through which small amounts of light can pass, and they can interfere beyond. And that's used, for example, throughout spectroscopy, because what it does is colour dependent, and you can analyse the colours of a source by that. But I want to ask, take some place fairly close and ask what the light is. Well, it's the sum of all the lights from the wavelengths. You've got to include the phases, of course, and there's some number, call it X, on which this depends. I don't go into details about that. Well, what do you do? You start with the wave from the first, then the second, then the third, fourth, and so on. Now, first one has this angle X. The second one has 4 times it, the next one 9 times it. That's the way it works, it's a square every time. And then you add them up, okay? Mathematically, these things are called Gauss sums. And it's a beautiful fact about them, that they are pathologically sensitive to this number X that you start with. I'm going to illustrate that now by showing you 10,000 little lines made according to this rule with different X's. I call them curlicues. If you look at the dictionary, a curlicue is a fantastic curl or twist. So here's my first number. It's a small number, about 0.05. And here's a curlicue from that. All it is simple rule. The little lines are too small to see. But they start by coiling up into a spiral, and then they unwind another one, and you realize you're making a spiral, spiral, and a spiral, spiral, spiral. Very strange. Let's look at another one. How about 1 over pi, okay? Then you get this horrible spider thing. How about the golden number that is supposed to, but actually doesn't, govern perspectives in harmonious shapes in architectural painting? Well, then you get the crystal number. That's strange. So these optical curlicues, these interference and sensitive dependent on where you are and on the wavelength and so on, are a kind of arithmetic microscope. The more you add together of these numbers, the more you penetrate the depths of this number X. There's a very beautiful mathematics with it, I'm not going to go into it, but just to say that for almost any choice of X, the pattern you get, if you look on the right scale, contains the curlicue for almost any other curlicue X. Very strange, not obvious from what I showed you, that truth. Now, this is hard to see experimentally, but something that was discovered in 1836 near Bristol, where I live, does actually depend on essentially the same mathematics. It's something called the Talbot effect. Henry Fox Talbot, a very great Victorian polymath, invented photography of the kind that everybody used until digital. Daguerre made very beautiful pictures, but only one at a time. Talbot invented the negative. He democratized the image because from one negative you could make infinitely many positives and send them around the world. And he was a physicist, and he discovered a fact about grating. Take a grating, let's say fine silk, and look at it with a magnifying glass. You look close. You can see focused the lines of the grating. Move it away, blurs away, goes out of focus. Then he discovered that at a certain distance, and multiples of that distance, it comes back into focus again. And he said, this must have something to do with interference, which it does. Much later, I'm now speaking of the 1960s, when these devices became technologically useful and interesting, we discovered that if you have a fraction of that distance, E divided by Q, like 3/7 or something, then you get more complicated reproductions of the original pattern, depending on these numbers, P and Q. So let me show you these patterns, an example of them. Here's the grid itself. Transparent and black. The simplest one is stripes. When you go down to the taller distance, and you get the same pattern, shifted a bit, but it's the same pattern. In between, you get these weird and wonderful structures. These, again, are these Gaussians arithmetic, which find their natural embodiment in this unfamiliar aspect of what to physicists is a very familiar device. I can't resist an equation. And for those who understand it, we love it. Those who understand it, doesn't matter. The mathematics that underlies all of this is the following. Minus 1 raised to the power n squared is minus 1 raised to the power n. It's a very beautiful thing. Well, all of this is what happens if you take these fractions. But most distances are not fractions. What happens if you look at some distance that's, say, 1 over square root of 2 times? Something you can't write as a fraction. What happens there? The answer is you get fractals. So I'm now going to speak about fractals, another group of mathematical phenomena. The pattern that you see, the intensity pattern across, is a fractal. It's a fractal is a curve, you probably know, but I want to tell you anyway. There's an infinitely wiggly curve. Smooth curves are one-dimensional. There's a way of describing wiggliness of curves, giving the curves a number between 1 and 2, which you can call the dimension. 2 is the limit, it fills an area. The coastline of England has a dimension of about 1.3. The more you magnify, the more structures you see. Now, in the case of these diffraction gratings, the dimension of the curve you see depends whether you're crosswise or lengthwise or diagonally. I've shown you, it's a very rich structure. So this is now scrunching up the longitudinal distance down to a square. If you look across, you get 1.5. If you look along, you get 1.75, which is more wiggly. If there are certain diagonal lines where you get 1.25. Very curious, unexpected fractions appear. Now, since really you're looking at something that exists crosswise and lengthwise, you should really plot this picture as a surface in two dimensions. And when you do that, you get what I call the mountains of Tolbert, which is a landscape of fractals, more wiggly than the Earth's landscape, a dimension of about 2.75. I think of this as the marriage of Tolkien and Mandelbrot. Now, physics, a very distinguished colleague of mine once said, physics is not only about the nature of things, it's about the connections between the different natures of different things. Nothing is more satisfying to a scientist, especially a physicist, when we discover that things that are apparently completely different actually have the same underlying structure. And there are analogies between optics and quantum physics, and particularly this effect, which I'm now going to tell you about. You see, in optics, you've got this distance from a grating. In quantum mechanics, it's time. In optics, you've got a wave equation that tells you how waves behave as you go to different distances from the grating. In quantum mechanics, it's the famous Schrödinger equation that governs change in quantum mechanics. So repetitions at different distances in quantum mechanics are revivals of some initial situation at different times. And these quantum revivals were discovered independently only in the last 20 years or so, and then it was realized that they're just the same structure as the Tolbert effect in optics. And I'm going to illustrate this to you. One of the physicists' favorite little expository toys, we call it the particle in the box. The box is only one dimension, it's a line. The particle bounces back and forth. So this is in classical physics. But here's a particle, and there's the left and right side of the box, and this is time now. So it starts off, it moves, it bounces, bounces, and so on. Now, in quantum mechanics, this is represented by a wave, a quantum particle, and I'm going to show you the equivalent period in the history of this particle. It's only 1/20th of the time before things revive with repetition. So there it is. And so here's this blurry wave going like a regular particle. It bounces, it interferes with itself because it's a wave, and it spreads, and then very quickly fills the whole space. And you think nothing more is going to happen. But actually, things do happen. If, let's go to just before you have half the revival time, so between 9/20ths and 10/20ths, which is a half. Now, you get all this chaos, and then suddenly it looks as though there are two particles appearing, because they're not two. I mean, what this isn't two particles, it's the probability of finding one, either one place or the other, gets concentrated. That's it. And if you look at the whole picture now, you get what we call a quantum carpet. It's woven by extreme interference. You see, the beginning, this is what I showed you at the beginning, the tiny beginning of bouncing, then at the end, it reproduces itself. The whole structure is hidden in there. And with electrons in atoms, or in outer orbits of in atoms, these structures are now beginning to be explored in other contexts too. This is quantum interference. Let me show you another fractal. This is in laser, inside a laser. The wave in the laser, this wave that you see leaking out, which exists much more intensely inside the laser, is called a mode. And in the usual kind of laser, like this one, called a stable laser, you've got two concave mirrors. I've exaggerated how close together they are, really much farther apart. And the wave that forms is the wave that self-reproduces after two journeys and two bounces. And then you make this slightly transparent in the way that leaks out is what you see, and the cross-section is this nice, clean, narrow shape. But for many practical purposes with powerful mirrors, you reverse one of the mirrors. And this gives rise to instability in the bouncing. The light leaks away from the edges of the mirrors, but the advantage is you use all the lasing material. Now, in the 1960s, people did calculations of these modes and found that they're completely different, they're very irregular. And it's been understood in the last few years that actually these modes are fractals, transversely, the shape. And they're fractals with dimension 2, because they're as wiggly as can be. And this struck. Okay, all mathematics is a model of the world. No model applies exactly. Models that we love apply very accurately, but they all have their limits. Nothing is really a fractal going down to infinite defined scales. It's a model. Here, it's a model that goes down to the scale of the wavelength. So as the wavelength gets smaller, this fractal emerges. The wavelength gets shorter and shorter. And here you see this infinite wiggliness emerging. In Holland, Hans Boordman, in his laboratory, has measured this fractal dimension. It's a most spectacular experiment, very difficult to do, and you get 1.99, and no theorist could go more than that. It's an extreme fractal, it's barely a difference. Now I come to my last topic. I want to speak about polarized light in crystals. It's one of my favorite subjects, a very beautiful area of interest. Light waves traveling through a transparent crystal oscillate sideways in one of two possible ways. They're called polarizations. So there you see the light going in the crystal, there are these two different possibilities. These two polarizations and the speeds with which these two different waves travel depend on direction according to another piece of mathematics called matrix algebra. Now, I'll tell you what a matrix is, I'll tell you what it does. A matrix is what the crystal does to the light, okay? A matrix algebra is this. You have this mathematical object, never mind what it looks like. But if you multiply the original light by it that comes in, you get the light that's in the crystal. And then, interesting things can happen. Sometimes, the light that you get in this way is the same as the light you started with. It's self-reproduction again. when that happens, you've got the original light was one of these two polarizations. That's how you find it. And there's two possible ways in which this can happen. Actually, it doesn't quite reproduce. It reproduces up to some number multiplied, and that number is the speed. Now, to see all this very beautifully, you see, the light travels through the crystal, the two waves go at different speeds, and they get out of step, out of phase. And you can make them interfere with something which I call a black light sandwich. And here's how you make it. You can do it yourself, I'll show you. You take two sheets of polaroids, which are all sunglasses at the right time, you do it. And, you know, each sheet of polaroid lets through light that goes in a particular direction. So you cross them. So the light going through here will be stopped by the light going through here. That's the bread of the sandwich. And if that were all there was to it, it would be black, because what was let through by one would be stopped by the other. But in between, you put a substance that's the most general kind of transparent substance whose properties depend on direction. Now, I've used the word crystal before, because that's what people are used to use. But you can do this by using overhead projector transparency foil, viewgraph foil, which has the same property. Okay, now when you do that, you look through it at the sky or something, or the wall, you look in different directions, and you see interference fringes joining directions where the two speeds differ by the same amount. So you're making a little mathematical contour map of these speeds. And that's what you see. And then there are these special places, these bullseyes. I'm in dispute with an editor about how to spell bullseyes. You can believe it. No, the question is, do you put the apostrophe S and then a hyphen? It seems hopelessly pretentious to be. Every dictionary except one has that spelling. I have to give in. Never mind. These are places where, this is what you suffer if you care about words. These places are places where the two speeds are the same. So the crystal is locally like an ordinary piece of glass waving the same in every direction. And if you do it with white light, then you get nice colours, because of course the interference depends on wavelength, depends on the colour. And then you see these black brushes. Well, that's an example of a geometric phenomenon. It was mentioned kindly in the introduction by Howard. It's called a geometric phase. It's a very, very rudimentary example of it, that the black stripe illustrates particularity in these polarizations, which I won't go into. It's very nice to make one of these and put it in front of your camera. Then whatever you take a picture of will have this structure in front of it. And because it isn't anywhere, it's always in focus. And you focus on what you want to focus on, in this case the trees and the garden for the physics department at Bristol University, and then you'll see this nice structure. Now, I'm going to be self-indulgent now because we're really close to the end. Crystal is a very beautiful subject. And if you take different crystals and put them through different kinds of polarizer, you get a variety of wonderful patterns. And when my colleague in Bristol heard that I was interested, he said, do you realize that in our laboratory, we've got a collection of these crystal specimens that has hardly been looked at for 100 years? And he gave me a box of about 100 crystal specimens. And I played in my little laboratory at home, took some pictures, and I just show you a few of these nice pictures. Just purely because they're beautiful. And I understand most of them. Oops. Now, I've told you about some mathematical phenomena, and let me run through them. 1 plus 1 equals 2. That is the intensities of light rays. 1 plus 1 is not equal to 2 for the intensities of light waves. A 2 to 1 map. Rainbows, a many to one map, the sparkling of the sun right on the sea. Mathematical catastrophes is focusing these constant types. Infinite series came into physics, or one of them, through the rainbow's dark side, understanding how the bright side and the dark side are related to each other. Zero in optics is a dark place of undefined phase. Knot theory, in black light, we can create these knots. Gauss sums, in this extreme interference, these curlicues I told you about. Projection from infinite dimensions to three, these colors of darkness that I showed you. Fractals, diffraction and unstable lasers. And matrix, algebra, matrix degeneracies, these polarized light bullseyes. Now, These are mathematical phenomena, and I've shown them in light, and any physicist can give you 100 other examples of how mathematics describes aspects of the world. But of course it's misleading to think that you can look around and look at light and see this mathematics. I mean, it took a long time for human culture civilization to develop and understand this. And this was, you need a conceptual framework. You have to see with the eye of theory. And this was put beautifully by Maxwell. He wrote it privately to himself in his diary when he was 23. Let me read you what he wrote. The dimmed outlines of phenomenal things all merge into one another unless we put on the focusing glass of theory and screw it up to one, sometimes to one pitch of definition and then to another, so as to see down into different depths through the great millstone of the world. A really wonderful thing for this young fellow to write. Now, the same idea that we see with our brains was expressed by another young man 100 years later. You will know it. The fool on the hill sees the sun going down. The eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Thank you for your attention. Somehow in the world or in our heads. I think the answer to that is that they're in the world because they're embodied in phenomena, like I've been describing to you. But those phenomena are described by our models and our pictures, people often, it's a famous phrase, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. How is it that we do this mathematics and then suddenly we find the matrices and integrals and you're just dreaming and suddenly you find them in the middle of the world. And here's my opinion about it. The world is infinitely rich and complicated. We understand a tiny, tiny bit of it. And as we go on, because we act, science is a collective enterprise and people acting together are clever, but people acting individually, we make progress that way. But still, we are limited as a species and we stumble along and gradually learn more and more, but still a tiny fraction. But what we understand is what we're capable of understanding. And being capable of understanding means being able to find in the world images of the most sophisticated thoughts that we're able to have. And the most sophisticated and formalized thoughts are in mathematics. So sometimes it's mathematics first, sometimes it's physics first, but they sort of, give or take 100 years, which is nothing in the evolution. They sort of stumble along together. And so we understand what we're capable of understanding, and the best we're capable of understanding in a particular file is mathematics. So I think that the mathematical phenomena, which is a term I introduced to irritate philosophers, it describes what I mean, and that's really one of the sort of hidden messages of this book. I can't see from here because it's really light. Thank you, Sharon. many different kinds of libraries? Well, there are really infinitely many, because it depends how you think about them. But one way you can think about them is through their colours, their wavelengths. So how quickly they wiggle up and down. And that can be any distance. So you can go from one window to the next, one window to the next. And that distance is anything you like. So there are infinitely many. No limit. That keeps us in business for a long time.
Which of the points do you not understand?
No, I understood those. It's the ones I didn't show. I've got lots of them. What do you mean towards the end, you mean the crystal pictures? Yeah, no, it's, I don't know what some of these crystal specimens are that I've got, not the ones I showed you, but other ones. And I think they may be composites, so you get kind of mixtures and combinations of different sorts of patterns and different bits of the crystal. It's not quite clear, because they're old, some of them mineralogical names are not as standard as you might think they should be. The names are written on, they're not easy to identify nowadays. And so some of them have a twin, and then you get combinations of patterns. So although I understand most of them, I don't understand all of them. But among the ones I showed you, I do understand. So I've got about 100 of them. Yeah, about 5 or 6, I think, puzzle.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
It's a very ancient form of mathematics that's starting to come back to some extent, called Vedic mathematics. Have you had a chance to explore that in any way?
I heard of it, and indeed my friend George Sudarshan, when he's in India, studies it, and he is a scholar of Sanskrit and ancient Indian culture. When he's in the USA, he does quantum optics. And you see, there's no contradiction between me and nor should there. The answer is no, I haven't studied it. But the little that I've seen from people who have indicate that, ways that are largely unfamiliar to us, those ancient people did understand a great deal of, certainly of arithmetic and the beginnings of algebra. When we can translate to the ways we know now, we can begin to see what they understood. Of course, you know, nowadays, because of the collective enterprise, I told you, one's got far beyond that. But nevertheless, you know, it's always interesting to understand the roots of our culture that are much deeper and wider than we tend to think. It's generally true. I mean, all the history of any subject is kind of foreshortened. I mean, if you're a historian, you're aware of the richness of the history of the subject. But most of us are lazy. And if you do physics, that's one thing. To do physics history is another thing. I haven't been particularly interested in it, but still, one's views of physics history are kind of narrowed. And this is certainly true of mathematics, and certainly true even more when you go across cultures. So thank you for that.
I'm just curious what light waves are made of. What are the components of light waves? What are they made of?
You have in your mind there, I suspect, a kind of constructor kit notion of physical objects, which is that they are made of small things put together. And that's not always the right picture. The way we understand it now, I didn't speak about this at all, but thank you for giving me the chance to do so, is that if you take a very sensitive detector, photographic plate will do it actually, and you take the interference patterns, and you make the intensity less and less and less and less, and then what you find is that instead of the whole pattern getting fainter and fainter and fainter, you begin to see it has gradients. And these are what are called photons. That's a subtle matter, which I don't want to go into too deeply, but nevertheless, the way the light arrives is point-like. And you see the wave structure when you look on a large scale, and what the waves give you is the probability that a photon will hit a particular place. And you can see this happen very nicely. There was an experiment done in 1908 or 9, G.I. Taylor, had an interference experiment and with a photo plate, and he calculated with then newly begin to appreciate the idea of photons, that at any one time the light was so faint there would be no photons in the apparatus. Occasion one would arrive. They went away on a sailing trip and came back, and the photo plate had formed a beautiful interference pattern over time made by these. They were impacts, random impacts, guided with their probability guided by the waves. So one way to answer your question is actually the best answer we can give now is to say that on the very finest scale, and I didn't speak about it today, on the very finest scale, you have photons that hit, and what the waves are, the probabilities that the photons are struck. You can't really think of the waves being made of, but that's not quite the right picture, but that's where they fit in. And your friend sitting next to you will tell you much more about that.
Okay, many of the mathematical ways of modeling are based on physics. And so they're based on coming up with a model that predicts the actual phenomenon. Other mathematical modeling is based on, if I create this model, I can predict what's happened, but it's not physically correct. They should deal with these two different ways of looking at mathematical modeling, and you get into generating the numbers, you get into predicting. At times you can lose what's reality, and you start basing your theory of what's going to happen based on, I know that if I put these numbers in, I model it this way, so I have some of those regression modeling, I can predict what's going to happen. So I start to think that's reality, and then I lose track of detail. I lose track of what's really happening. How do you, when you're getting into that modeling, continually come back and question, am I just able to predict the answer, or am I able to understand why that answer is going to happen?
Well, you weren't drawing attention to this phenomenon, but to philosophers is a logical possibility, but which is actually happens, that any given phenomenon can be accounted for by an infinite number of different models. Okay. Now, in physics, we have a rather strong conceptual framework. Don't think don't make a mistake. Of course, we do. We have a rather strong conceptual framework from which we can choose our models. But in other subjects, particularly in biology, you don't. And the only answer I can give is to how you can distinguish, which I think is your question, how you can distinguish a model which gives correctly predicts a phenomenon and which is based on mechanisms which are true to the underlying causes from a model which predicts a phenomenon which has no relation to the underlying causes is by looking at the details. I mean, that's all you can say. You look at the ingredients that make up the model and try to test them separately. There's no substitute for that hard work. There's no general recipe for that. I don't know if that is what you had in mind.
So mine was more of a philosophical question of how do you keep from starting to look at something that generates the correct answer as being reality, when in fact, in some cases, some mathematical model is just the way to predict what will happen. It's not physical. You mentioned about biological.
Well, we never really know, but in a deep sense, all of our theories are wrong. All our models are wrong. Light waves is wrong because the more deeply you've got waves. Light waves is wrong because the more deeply you've got photons. And we model at levels that are appropriate to the phenomena we're looking at, and we will see the whole structure overturned every century or so. So in that sense, we're always wrong. But on the more mundane level, you just have to look at the details. There's no philosophical answer. There's hard work and science. It's not a question of philosophy, it's a question of scientists. Is that working? I'll repeat it anyway.
Okay. have a question.
Okay, great. Are you familiar with Goethe's theory of color?
Yes.
And what do you think of it?
Well, what I think is the following. The question that I have from is Goethe's theory of color. Now, Goethe was a brilliant and pugnacious individual who presented his theory as a falsification of the idea of colour as being as Newton and then Thomas Young and others by today describe, which you could describe any colour that you see with your eyes by three numbers. Now, the way we see it now, it's all understood and resolved. And Goethe's theory has its place, and here's the way to say it. There are two strands of colour physics, colour science. One comes down from Newton, Thomas Young, Maxwell, Schrödinger, and played a part too. And the other is Goethe and Edwin Land. And based on this, you see, much of what you see as colour at a given point on your retina depends on the light that hits that point. I spoke about it, you project down from. But some aspects of colour that you see at a particular point depend on what you see at other places. They depend on context. Goethe discovered this with certain phenomena of coloured shadows. We're familiar with it with what's called colour constancy. The red of a London bus looks the same to us whether we see it in the dim light, in the mist, or we see it on a snowy day, on an overcast day. If you take a chromometer and measure the light that comes out, the colours can look completely different. This is the same. Our brain does post-processing. And the way to say this is this. The Newton, etc. way of looking at light is what we call the local physics of colour. And Goethe, Thomas Land, is the non-local theory. So there are aspects of what you see at a given point in the field of view that depend on the light that hits the retina at that point. There are aspects of what you see, which are post-processing beyond in the brain, depend on the light that hits other neighboring points. And that's not all completely understood exactly what the integration is from the neighboring points down to the one point, and there's very contemporary discussion about that. But that's essentially what Goethe discovered, and that's how we see it. And there's really no opposition at all. It's local versus non-local. Nobody ever says it this way, but when you can say it, it makes it immediately clear. They're just complementary ways, and they're part of the picture. And what I was describing there, I think you need that second part, but it's certainly there.
Thank you.
Well,
this is actually it's quite nice. And so inspired by the, first of all, before I move on to the thank yous, I'd like to begin with thanking our speaker one more time for a very stimulating evening. And now that I'm up at the microphone, and I've been inspired by the recent Academy Awards, I'd like to thank people individually who have hitherto gone nameless and being thought. So I'd like to thank my parents. People working at Perimeter Institute, staff Debbie Gunther, Richard F., Han Lau, Joe Stompner, Greg Willis, Sheena Giltz. And once again, I'd like to thank the individuals at Waterloo Collegiate Institute for making it possible to be here. In particular, I have names of students who have helped out as well. And Ellis, I'll be mispronouncing these names, so bear with me, I apologize. Raton Chager, Lee Zhang, Eric Morris, Robin Haig, and Joel Cox, as well as teachers here at WCI, Dave Froelich, Kirk DeRouter, DeRouter, I believe, and I'm sure there are other people I'm forgetting, but I think we all owe them a round of applause for making such a next month we have Bob and Ellen Kaplan from the Math Circle. They're going to do an interesting informal to and fro, give and take discussion on the wonders of their pedagogy for teaching mathematics to people who are otherwise shy of being immersed in a mathematical environment. Now, obviously, nobody here tonight fits that description, but you should come out anyway. Bring your children and any math folks and any teachers and anybody who would be part of a wonderful stimulating evening. So that's on April the 7th, I believe, the first Wednesday of April at any rate. And thank you all very much for attending tonight.